they looked at who was the beneficiary of TIF money. And so they did a grading at the Bank of America. And so coming up with these kinds of tactics that build people's confidence, come up with creative ways of engaging with the public and working and building up from there. And we see what CTU did. I mean, they started out with a small group of teachers that read the Shock Doctrine together, and they transformed and radicalized this larger union.
Wow.
One of the things that I do know is that Plumbers 290, rank and file plumbers, are actually out there trying to organize with the plumbers. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. The plumbers and pipe fitters. Yeah. We are actively organizing. Yes.
I mean, the rank and filers are doing it themselves.
We do have members. Mostly the ones that are organized in are the most helpful in helping organize in those that are unorganized.
Member leaders, that's what it takes. All right, shucks, guys, I hate to cut it off, but it's now 6:30 and we've run out of time. Thank you, Hyung, John, and Jeff, for joining us this evening. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for doing this.
And
have a good night.
Yeah, you guys definitely have a good night. And thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The religion of Judaism and the political philosophy of Zionism must be completely separated. Judaism is a religion. Zionism is a political philosophy. And this confusion is well done to keep people more confused. But we're revolutionaries and we believe in dialectics. Out of confusion comes clarity.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, April 27th at 6 p.m., will be a screening of Kwame Ture on Zionism as Africa's Enemy at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, gives a talk on the Zionist movement, the difference between Zionism and Judaism. Again, that's the Pan-African Film Series of Kwame Ture on Zionism as Africa's Enemy, Wednesday, April 27th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union, room 236 at PSU, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:30. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight, we're going to be talking about sentencing reform and ways of dealing with the mass incarceration problems. My guest tonight is Jason Zeidenberg. Jason is the Justice Policy Institute's Director of Policy and Research. In this role, Jason has strategic and operational responsibility for generating and coordinating JPI's research and policy work. He's held staff positions with the Washington, D.C. Department of Youth Rehabilitative Services and here in Portland with the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. He's been a consultant to the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, the National Center for Victims of Crime, the U.S. Justice Department's National Institute of Corrections, Evidence-Based Associates, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Washington Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights and Urban Affairs, the Campaign for Youth Justice, and the NAACP. And he's authored publications for 24 juvenile and criminal justice policy organizations and initiatives. He is one of the best minds in criminal justice, one of the best young minds in criminal justice in the country today. It is an honor to have him on the show, and an even bigger honor to call him my friend. Jason, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very well, Doug. Glad to be on with you this evening.
Again, the pleasure is mine. So let's just get straight to it. Sentencing reform. Now, you know, actually, we were together on the radio here at KBOO several months ago on a, on a morning talk show. Of course, I have a subspecialty in drug policy, so we were talking about alternatives to incarceration and the dealing with nonviolent drug offenders. Towards the end of that conversation, you made the very, very serious point that nonviolent drug offenders, yes, an obvious problem, but that's not going to solve the problem of mass incarceration. And so let's start talking about the rest of what we need to do. Tell me about some of the work you're doing, and tell folks about JPI.
So the Justice Policy Institute, is a Washington D.C.-based think tank. Basically, what we do is provide policymakers with the facts around what's going on in the criminal justice system, as well as trying to take a very complicated criminal justice system, a $250 billion system that has about 5 million people under supervision between prisons, jails, parole, and probation, and really explain to the average person why we need to change policy here and why we need different policies and how we can have safe communities with fewer people locked up. And primarily, the organization's mission is to promote the notion that we can have safer communities, we can have healthier communities, and not see 2.3 million people incarcerated.
Now, you have been doing work at the federal level and at the state level. Let's get the feds out of the way. Any chance we're going to see sentencing reform, meaningful sentencing reform this year?
So far, it's not looking good. I think there's a couple of things going on. First of all, we should pay some credit to those elected officials, both on the left and the right, who have gotten behind a series of sentencing reform proposals this year, many of which would have focused on people convicted of drug offenses and tried to create paths to their exit from the federal system. I think there's two things going on. Number one, as all of your listeners know, there's a presidential election coming. There's a congressional election coming, and as part of that, the politics in Washington, D.C. does change a bit, so it's very hard to marshal anything in this environment. I think another thing that's going on that we're all going to have to study very carefully once we get through the summer and into the fall is, have we created a narrative around criminal justice reform which isn't as effective as we hoped it would be? And I think that squarely rests on the issue around how we emphasize different categories of people in prison and the ease at which people that are opposed to really seeing any change can sort of take those arguments apart. If we could talk a little bit about people ending up in prison on drug offenses, I think we could sort of get to the root of that a bit.
Oh, absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. So here's where I think we've run into trouble. We have been promoting a message, and early on in this movement, and you've been part of this movement, Doug, we've done polling and focus groups to see where the public's been at on prison reform, and really narrowed a lot of our proposals to deal with what we thought are consensus positions. That is, that this notion of a quote-unquote nonviolent offender, that's who we should be focusing in on reducing the incarceration of. And if you were to look at a wonderful resource done by a group called the Prison Policy Institute, they basically have generated something called the whole pie. Google it and take a look at it. It's basically a picture of what 2.3 million people look like who are locked up and their quote-unquote most serious offense. And then we break that into categories. Quote-unquote drug offenders, people incarcerated for violent offenses, people incarcerated for burglary, weapons, all sorts of terms that relate to really one event, which is the event that led to their current incarceration. Doesn't tell you anything about the person's propensity to change. Doesn't tell you anything about their age. Doesn't tell you about what we're doing with them, for them, or for the community as a result of their incarceration. All it tells you is what happened the day that a judgment was made by a court that led to their incarceration. In the federal debate around sentencing reform proposals that have been framed and focused in on the release of the quote-unquote nonviolent drug offender, we've had some senators that have been able to sort of pick that apart a bit, and some law enforcement officials pick that apart a bit and say, well, wait a second here. Somebody in prison on a quote-unquote nonviolent drug offense might have more going on in their background than just that, and have brought out all sorts of individual cases that have looked at the deeper histories that a lot of people have when they end up in prison. And that's unfortunately a reality that we have to navigate. The fact of the matter is, when somebody ends up in prison, it's usually at a point where a couple of events have happened in terms of their contact with the criminal justice system, and that one event, that offense that led to their incarceration, is probably not the only thing going on. We would argue at the Justice Policy Institute is that we can't make these sort of cookie-cutter distinctions around that one event of a person's offense. So we have to start making a little bit more of a nuanced argument here, which talks about a whole bunch of issues that relate to the reason why someone ends up engaging in criminal activity or behavior we don't like, what else we can be doing with that person to help them change their behavior, and take into account that along with that singular event, there's a lot else going along on in that person's life. It could have been a lack of access to education. Could have been a lack of access to job training. It could have been a whole history a family might have had with the criminal justice system, which we know from the statistics means that they'll be more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system themselves. It has to do with our policing patterns. And it has to do with where we deploy law enforcement resources in a particular community. So I'm saying all this not to say that we shouldn't be focusing on drug policy reform or reforms that would see people convicted of drug offenses back in the community or receiving some alternative sanction. What I'm saying is that if we ever want to get to a point where the U.S. incarceration rate, let's say at its best, is more like the Western European average, we would need to reduce the incarceration of about 1.2 million people. That's about the gap that we would have to make up between the 2.3 million we're locking up now and reductions of the incarceration down to the European, Western European average. That's going to mean that we're going to have to reduce the number of people locked up across a series of categories, including people that end up going to prison whose most serious offense may be defined by the statute as a violent crime. I think that's where we're going to have to face some interesting realities in terms of making the kind of changes we want to see in this country. And to some degree, our narrative around the search for the quote-unquote nonviolent prisoner who's had nothing go wrong in their life and will make where everything will go right once they're released. I think that narrative has been challenged this year a bit.
Quite a bit, actually. So, and really, it's two sorts of problems. One is how do we deal with the current population, and the other is how do we stop feeding the, if you'll pardon me for working the name of the show into the discussion, how do we stop feeding the prison pipeline?
Correct. Pipeline is a good expression. People can wrap their heads around it, particularly if you're in the West, or they're involved in the resource sector. What a pipeline means to me is it starts in schools that refer young people out of the classroom instead of resolving conflict within the school. It continues in neighborhoods where the kind of activity that you or I might have engaged in as young people is monitored at a different level because of the level of policing that goes on in that community. It continues upstream if there's no alternatives to incarceration or range of options available to the courts. If there's no range of options, that person ends up in jail. Once you've ended up in jail, it's much more likely that you will lose your housing status, lose your job, and have all sorts of negative consequences down the line. That might lead to more criminal activity, which then leads to a person ending up in prison. And then you're part of a pipeline, which after a couple of years in prison, you might return to the community. Then you become part of that two-thirds of people that within 3 to 5 years recidivate in some way. Their activity is seen again by the law, by law enforcement is measured. There's a court response to that, and that person then ends up in prison again. So it's a very challenging problem we've created here in this country. Digging out of it is going to require some much broader thinking about how we change the entire pipeline. And I think that's the challenge that we've started to see this year in terms of the federal agenda. And to the degree that we're monitoring different states at the Justice Policy Institute, we're seeing some challenges at the state level, too.
Well, let's talk about one of those states first, though. But to make sure people know who they're listening to, this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. You're listening to The Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Doug McVeigh. My guest is Jason Zeidenberg with the Justice Policy Institute. We're discussing sentencing reform and how to deal with incarceration and how to reduce incarceration. And well, you mentioned the states, and that's really where most of the prisoners are, jails or prisons are in the states. Maryland, right next door to D.C., and I know JPI has been working on Maryland issues for quite some time. We co-wrote a paper back in 2002 looking at Maryland with alternatives to incarceration. You folks are doing some work. I saw there's a lot of stuff happening, I know, in Maryland. What's going on there?
So there's a couple of things going on there. There's been renewed focus on criminal justice reform nationally, as you know, in the past year. And in Maryland, and particularly at the epicenter in Baltimore, the tragic events around Freddie Gray's death brought the overuse of the criminal justice system into very stark relief. At the time that that offense occurred, there was a study that we put out called The Right Investment, which basically showed where people in Maryland who are in the Maryland prison system are from, and it basically showed that the community that Freddie Gray was from had the highest incarceration rate of any part of the state, and $17 million a year was being spent locking up about 500 people from that community in Maryland prisons. When that information came out and the Freddie Gray incident occurred, it created this notion of, well, we need to be investing more in the communities most impacted by crime and incarceration in Maryland. While, you know, that was becoming a bit of the discourse in the state, a bill was introduced to have Maryland go through something called a justice reinvestment process. State of Oregon also went through a justice reinvestment process a couple of years ago. Maybe we can come back to that in a minute. But basically that involves getting all the stakeholders involved in criminal justice that work in the criminal justice system, defense attorneys, prosecutors, sheriffs, legislators, people involved in behavioral health, governor's cabinet, get them all around the table and talk about, well, how are some ways we could actually reduce the amount of money we're spending on prisons and invest more in these approaches outside of the prisons that might promote public safety in a different way. That Justice Reinvestment Group studied the issue. They came out with a set of recommendations in December, which basically laid out a roadmap for reducing Maryland's prison population by 14% and reinvesting about $250 million that was spent on prisons over the next 10 years in approaches in communities that were less reliant on incarceration. So that's a mouthful, if you can follow me up to this point. What then happened was a bill was offered in the name of the Justice Reinvestment Report that was offered in December. The bill went through a whole series of revisions, and we're just trying to figure out now if all of those reforms that would have led to a 14% reduction are still in there. Maryland is a quote-unquote progressive state. This is not one of our southern states that has a reputation of being right on crime. This is a state that's advanced in a whole bunch of progressive policy changes. If we're to understand where the debate landed in the last couple of days of the legislature, they were debating at a fierce level whether judges and prosecutors would give up small amounts of their discretion to put somebody behind bars in exchange for other sentencing changes. The legislature in Maryland just came to a close today. It's actually still open for 3 more hours, and they're still debating issues. We're poring through the bill to really understand what happened. But basically, a consensus bill of which prosecutors, public defenders, and judges all agreed earlier on would reduce the prison population by 14% and reinvest money up to a tune of $250 million over 10 years in other public safety approaches was substantially watered down. And we're just trying to figure out exactly how much water was poured into that process. And we look forward to reporting back to you and your listeners exactly what happened. For me, the point of the story is we are going to have to build a much stronger movement for sentencing reform than just these processes that operate at an elite level with the stakeholders in the justice system. And that's going to take years to build. That's what I think we've learned from this process.
Well, so give us a roadmap. Where should we be looking? What direction, any ideas of what directions we should be looking at?
Sure. So part of any public policy process where you're asked to offer your opinion, the Justice Policies Institute has been working with the folks that have been part of this Justice Reinvestment Committee for the last 6 months on here's what we think needs to happen. I think the biggest thing that needs to happen is we need to make sure that the communities most impacted by crime and violence are at the table setting policy around these issues. In this Justice Reinvestment Council that offered up these reforms, there were about 19 government officials and one person representing one nonprofit that works directly with impacted communities. I don't think that's what's going to make the difference over the long term. So that's one thing. Second, we have to start having a public conversation with people about whether someone who committed a serious act a long time ago should be serving a life sentence, should be serving a de facto life sentence of 20 to 30 years, should be serving a decade or a decade and a half in prison, or should have those collateral consequences that we layer on people for certain offenses, such as sex offenses. I think that's the only way we're going to actually start reducing the prison population in a substantive way. And that's going to take a whole lot of public education. It's going to take getting a whole bunch of people out there to garner the sympathy of the public and the understanding of the public, in a way that we've been trying to do around drug policy reform. That's going to challenge a lot of people's comfort zone. But as far as I can see from a mathematical equation, that's the only path to actually getting to 1.2 million fewer people locked up. And one other thing that I think we can't just have sentencing reform, prison reform, policing reform happen alone. There have been some very thoughtful writers in the last few years that have talked about the need for a Marshall Plan-like investment in the communities most impacted by crime and violence. We need to see that level of investment at the same level that we saw around the 1994 crime bill that put so much money into expanding prisons around this country and at the federal level. So it may sound like this is a huge agenda, but we have a huge problem here. And the only way we're going to solve it is to start building the kind of social movement and the kinds of connections with other social movements that can sustain the kind of policy changes we want to see.
Very true. I mean, in a smaller level, drug policy reform is going to face the same thing. Sure. Marijuana, yeah, less dangerous than alcohol, okay, decriminalize. Heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine. And suddenly drug policy reformers start to get a little queasy about that. And it's like, no, we have to deal with these things and deal with them head on. And that's, it's just what you have to do.
Yeah, right. And I think it's a challenge as Americans to try to have incremental change and to be satisfied with that. If I were among the family members of the 60, 70 people that were recently commuted by President Obama, I'd be thrilled to have my family member come home. So we have to take some satisfaction in that. And to the degree to which drug policy is changing in Oregon around marijuana, and that there's a broader conversation in a number of states about treatment because of what's going on with the opioid crisis, at least that's a beginning from which we can build on. The justice reinvestment process I just described in Maryland, and which also had occurred in Oregon, you got to start somewhere. I think our challenge is to build much bigger than just that.
And that is probably a good spot for us to wrap. We're at the top of the hour. The clock has beaten us once again. It keeps doing that. Any final thoughts? And Jason, what's your website?
So the website is www.justicepolicy.org. And I do have a final thought.
Good.
The final thought would be this. I think that it's good news that we are seeing this debate around criminal justice reform in a way that we haven't seen in the past, certainly not when you and I were trying to get something going with our colleagues around a movement around drug policy reform. Rather than to talk about what happened 20 years ago, I think that our challenge is going to be to translate that into concrete policy reform in 2016. And to just give your listeners one last statistic, the last prisoner survey showed that the prison population dropped by about 1% around the country. Jail populations went up about 1.3%. Whatever small gains we're making, if you really want to see the U.S. incarceration rate come down, we can't yet call that progress.
Indeed. And again, Jason, I cannot thank you enough. We've been talking with Jason Zeidenberg with the Justice Policy Institute. He is one of the best people in the country on these issues, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. My name is Doug McVeigh. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next week on Prison Pipeline, co-hosts Emma Lugo and Mindy Griffiths will interview Becky Murr and Andy Martin about arts programs within the prison system. The Prison Arts Coalition, established in 2008, serves as a national network for prison arts in the United States. and that'll be a great show. Looking forward to it. I want to thank our engineer. I want to thank you again, Jason, for giving your time to me tonight. Thank you. This has been a great. It's been great chatting with you.
Great to be on as always. Take good care, Doug.
You too, Jason. And thanks to the folks at Prison Pipeline for allowing me to sit in this evening. This has been Prison Pipeline, and I wish you good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival will be held this year from July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 4-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
The time is 7 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned.
Greetings, yo, what's up, y'all? It's your homegirl, Mystic, and you are now listening to Hard Knock Radio.
What up,